Good evening. Hey, it's the Malloy program. Thanks for tuning in. Yeah, the music's going to be a little bit different tonight. All the music is, I guess. This is our Halloween program, which we have done every Halloween. What, Kathy? 10 years? 15 years? We start out tonight. We will have usual topics that we normally have on this program, but also tonight, podcast trivia. That's coming up fairly quickly tonight, probably within this hour. And at the bottom of the next hour, my reading of Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart, which you don't want to miss. Welcome to the fires of the new year and the three nights of summer's end. Samhain marks the end of the old and the beginning of the new, linking us with the world of spirit at the turning of the year. October 31st, when we celebrate Halloween, is the last night of the old year. November 2nd is the first night of the new year. And the night of November 1st is the night between the two that belongs to no time. Our modern Halloween stems from the Celtic Samhain. It is a sacred time when the veil between this world and the other world is so thin that the dead can walk with us and warm themselves at our hearths. It is also the time when some mortals, especially shamans and poets, are able to find entrance to the other world through special doorways that open only at Samhain. This is a time of transformation from summer to winter, from the time of growth and bounty above ground to the time of storing the harvest in the root cellar below ground. Although the seasons in Faerie are not quite so pronounced, nature in the other world follows the cycles of life as well. So the process of moving from outside to inside, from exuberant growth to nurturing dreams, affects the fairies' way of life just as it does ours. There are many choices that need to be made at this time of transition from endings to beginnings. For us in the modern mortal world, the decisions are often metaphorical, but there are important realities behind the metaphors. Of the crops that you have grown this past year, which do you want to put into the root cellar to feed yourself and your family through the winter, and which do you save as seed to plant in the spring? Of the animals birthed last spring, which can you afford to feed through the winter and use to breed for next year, and which ones will feed and clothe you and your family through this cold time? As we see the fields of dead corn stalks waiting for harvest, or the brilliant colors of leaves in their last moments before becoming compost, the turning of the year and the movement from life to death is unmistakable. That these dying leaves should grace us with such beauty has always struck one as a fairy magic. There are many rituals from around the world to mark this time and to honor the energy it brings to our lives. The rituals we know and suggest to you all center around endings and beginnings and acknowledging the possibility of the existence of a world beyond our usual awareness. So on these three nights of summer's end, set a place at the table for your ancestors who want to visit. Leave food outside your door for other spirits so that they might bless your home for the coming year. Make a bonfire outside. Throw into it everything you want to clean out of your life from the year past. In the morning, bring coals inside to start your hearth fire for the new year. If you have nowhere to make a fire, turn off all the lights in the house, light a candle, and use the flame to burn small scraps of paper on which you've written that which you want to dispose of. In the morning, light a candle to welcome the new year and keep you warm through the coming winter. With the veil between the worlds so thin, it's a great time for divination. So take out runes or tarot cards. As you or your children walk the streets in costumes, remember that the real spirits and the fairy are walking with you. Bridget Wolf at fairywoodland.com wrote that. You can visit her website anytime you want to, fairywoodland.com. Samhain. So here we are again. We have done holiday programs. So are we going to do a Christmas show? Are we going to call it Christmas or are we going to call it winter solstice this year? I mean, why do Christmas and not Hanukkah or Eid or some festival other than... I think this year we'll stay with the traditional stuff that we've always done, but we're going to call it... what are we going to call it? The Winter Solstice Festival.
Malloy's Half Price Sale.
Malloy's Half Price Sale? You've been nipping at the mistletoe berries already? Because of all the lies that we have dealt with, especially the 8 years during the Bush-Cheney crime spree, and all the lies that took us into a war that media and the right in this country insisted if we didn't engage in, it would be the end of society or civilization as we knew it, the war against Saddam. In fact, prior to George Jr. invading, George Sr. invaded, and back in 91, when the run-up to that war was beginning, we were told that Saddam Hussein was the greatest threat to world peace since that old booger bear, Adolf Hitler. Do you remember? I realize that was 20 years ago, but do you remember? If you're 30 years old, no, of course you don't. But if you're 40 or 50, you might remember. Remember that? All the lies regarding the terror alerts during 8 years of the Bush crime family. And usually right before an election. Because of all that, I certainly have a lot of questions about the events of today. There's a part of me that wants to just stand back and say, oh, hog snot, you guys aren't trying this again. Oh, look what came on a UPS plane. Oops. Or was it FedEx? Or was it DHL? No, they don't exist anymore, do they? Oh, my God. Empty inkjet cartridges with plastic inside, ready to blow up. Really? Of course, none of it made it here. But here we go again. We are 3 days. Well, I mean, we all know what this means. Jesus, God, vote Republican. Vote Republican. They're the only ones that'll save us. They're coming. I swear to God, Al-Qaeda, the Yemenis. Yemeni, 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 Yemeni. We'll be right back. You better stop the thing that you do. I said, oh, watch out, I ain't lying. Yeah, I ain't gonna take none. Oh!
Spend your day screaming with Mike Malloy.
What? 21 past the hour. The story, in case you missed it, and I don't know how you could miss it unless you are really, really rational and sane, which means you don't have a television in your house. But even so, if you listen to any kind of radio broadcasting today, you heard it. Two packages containing that stuff and originating in Yemen, bound for two synagogues in Chicago, set off a global terror alert today. One package was found at a FedEx facility in Dubai, and another one was found early Friday morning at an airport in Britain. This afternoon, the President of the United States issued a statement. He called the packages, quote, a credible terrorist threat against our country, end quote. And confirmed that they, quote, did apparently contain, end quote, explosives. Earlier reports had said the devices found in Britain did not. The wild-scale alert spread to the United States on Friday morning when officials isolated two cargo planes at airports in Newark and Philadelphia and searched them for packages originating in Yemen. And New York police searched a delivery truck in Brooklyn. Can you imagine how that driver felt? Guy driving, right? Oh, my God. Guy driving a FedEx truck in Brooklyn. Yeah, man, I just want to hurry up and get out of here. You know, I'm going to take the kids out. We're going to the school for the thing, you know. And then I'm not saying they talk that way in Brooklyn. I'm just pretending, all right? Okay. And all of a sudden, you know, I look in my rearview mirror, right? And holy jumping God, I never saw anything. Saints preserve, you should have seen what I saw back there, right? No, not cops. Christ, it looked like the whole army was after me. What am I doing? I'm delivering, right? Can you imagine that poor bastard? Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. This afternoon, fighter jets escorted a passenger jet from Dubai to John F. Kennedy Airport because the plane had cargo from Yemen. Mr. Obama said, quote, the events of the last 24 hours underscores the necessity of remaining vigilant against terrorism. And the American people should be confident that we will not waver in our resolve to defeat al-Qaeda, end quote. That's insanity. I mean, it's insanity on the part of our foreign policy and our president. Yeah, our president, too. Did the British defeat the rebellion in Northern Ireland? Did the French defeat the rebellion in Algiers? Did the United States assist in defeating the rebellion in Vietnam? No, of course not. Al-Qaeda would probably wither and die if a couple very simple things would happen. Very simple. Very simplistic, very stupid. Your typical liberal approach to something, you know, try to be reality-based here, you know. You know how those liberals are, right? Withdraw from Afghanistan. Stop blowing up Pakistan. Withdraw from Iraq completely. None of this 50,000 people left there to train. Oh, hogsnot. Withdraw from wherever we are in the Muslim world. And stop threatening to start sending drones and predators and unmanned aircraft into Yemen to start fighting the mighty Al-Qaeda there. That's all of that was A. B is begin being even-handed where it concerns the Israeli-Palestinian issues. Stop. Supporting Israel, no matter what, in its apartheid attitude toward the Palestinians. Go to work. Really go to work, Mr. Obama! in helping to establish a Palestinian state, if that idea is still viable. Stop blaming the victim where it concerns the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And yes, the victims are the Palestinians. The Palestinians did not invade countries with large Jewish populations and say, we're establishing here in our homeland a Palestinian presence. No, they didn't do that. They really didn't do that. Now, if A and B are followed, I would be willing to bet that in a very short period of time, if not immediately, the problems between the United States and the Muslim world would stop. Before the hour, Joe in Temecula, California, and I would imagine an awful lot of other people, too, are really kind of questioning the events of today that the cable freaks just gave wall-to-wall coverage to. Oh, God. Joe writes, Mike, I don't know about you, but I am really getting tired of these terrors and threats right before elections. It's been happening since 2004. I find it to be highly suspicious on all fronts. Obama has done very little to curb the unitary executive powers that Bush Cheney seized. Little has been done to roll back the Patriot Act or stop any of the various constitutional violations ranging from warrantless wiretapping, data mining, internet search monitoring, extrajudiciary assassination, and rendition. I just find it all disturbing. I don't see much difference anymore between our own clandestine organizations and these terrorist organizations. They have infiltrated each other to the point where it's hard to tell who is calling the shots. I am also not sure what the point of a terrorist threat just before elections would be this time. Is it to bolster already heavily media-favored teabagger Republicans that claim to be tough on terror, even though 9/11 happened on their watch? Is it meant to help Obama to make him appear presidential and in charge? If this is truly a terrorist plot from start to finish, what is their motivation? What are they trying to achieve politically from it? And where is Dick Cheney? Where is Dick Cheney if not spending time in the shadows? These are just questions that go through my head when this stuff happens, particularly when the media decides to give it wall-to-wall 24-hour coverage. I think by giving it so much attention, we only encourage it, whoever may be behind it. I don't put it past our own CIA or Al-Qaeda to pull these types of pranks before our elections. And lest anyone think I'm nuts, it was not that long ago that a CIA operative who was believed to have infiltrated Al-Qaeda blew himself up at a CIA outpost in Afghanistan. Again, I ask, who is calling the shots and for what purpose? Joe in Temecula, California. Well, that's something that we'll not know. I mean, we just won't know. I've become so cynical and so distrusting of right-wingers. They are monsters. They are killers. Capitalism, corporatism will do anything to seize the final bit of control that they're still lacking. Anything to the point of having their operatives, someone in the CIA or the DIA or the NSC or whatever, someone within those ranks being instructed to load onto transport jets bogus explosive-looking stuff and maybe a little bit of real ignitable junk, and then tip-off. The tip-off, interestingly, according to CNN, came from Saudi Arabia. Yawn. What is that? Is that to repair? Is this to cover up the fact that we just sold $50 billion worth of weaponry? See, you never know. Anything that occurs in the Middle East is 80% mirage, 10% the absolute reverse of whatever reality is involved, and another 10% utter speculation. So the flights begin in the Middle East. The tip-off comes from the Middle East. Please. Dave in L.A. writes, Mike, this whole explosive story on the news today is bull blank. When I first saw an article about it on a news website today, I actually tuned it out and stopped reading. My first reaction was, this is more bull blank, this time fed to the American public right before the election to show that they are keeping us safe. I simply don't believe anything of the sort propagated by mainstream media and our elected officials anymore. Nothing like a few ghosts and goblins right before an election. Happy Halloween, Dave, in L.A. Jamie in Maryland writes, Mike, another one, add another one to the laugh track or the pyre. It was fascinating to hear Republicans, conservatives, and teabaggers go on and on today about how Obama better keep us safe from terrorist attacks on the same day when it was clear, or at least reported, that the Obama administration had, in fact, foiled an attempted attack on this country. Wow, what that alternate reality they live in just keeps on giving, doesn't it? Wouldn't want a fact to prick that bubble, eh? Happy Halloween, Jamie in Maryland. But yeah, that's how much of an apostate, non-believer, freak, liberal, I think they're all crazy, I've become. Seriously. Seriously. Two great big old jetliners stopped. One on the ground before it even takes off, and the other one in Britain. Ooh, look what's here. And then the follow-up, stopping some FedEx driver in Brooklyn. Can you imagine that guy? And a flight is landing, what was it, one of the Middle Eastern airlines, what was it, Al-Qaeda Airlines? Oh, wait, they don't have a real airline yet, do they? I don't know, maybe they do. Dubai, was it Dubai Airlines? Where is it? So a flight from the UAE or Dubai or wherever is escorted by U.S. fighter jets as it lands. Where'd it land? Philly? Someplace? I don't know. And the reason it is escorted is because our crack intelligence divisions within this country that are always there trying to protect us from stuff gets the information somehow to the Air Force. Was it Air Force jets? That there was a shipment, a piece of luggage, something on this jet. So, you'll forgive my absolute disgusting non-belief in all this. Just can't do it. I can't do it. I cannot do it. from Dr. Sachs, who plays with the Count Basie Band and travels around the world. This comes from, well, he writes, thanks for reading my email a couple of weeks ago. I always get a kick out of you reading them on the air. I really enjoyed the call from the guy, the Music Factory, from upstate New York the other night. He hit things right on the head for me. We played Ithaca and Port Henry just the day before that, so his poignant views were meaningful to me. We just arrived in the Netherlands, flew to Munich, then connected to Cologne, then bussed to here. Long travel, lots of security at the Munich connection. I know why, but I admit I was tired and just was a bit frustrated, but I know they have to do it. And then when I get here, I hear on Randy's show about the planes and suspicious packages and the security alerts. And then I see on Euronews that JFK has a security drill going on. We just flew out of JFK on Thursday. No CNN International here, so I miss my constant news feed. I've been meaning to sit and write a letter about my travels, my current disgust and despair about this election. I did send in my absentee ballot. My mother has a master's in social work and used to go to marches in Pittsburgh for civil rights, voting rights, housing rights. And I'm aware of all the people who fought, got beat up and died so I can vote. So I go down there and vote for Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, and my grandmother. My mother's 87. And still votes every time. Anywho, one black man gets elected president and America loses its collective mind. Next thing you know, we have witches and bitches running for Senate, liars and thieves, a hitman, and a collection of certifiable insane people who want to stop paying taxes, the same taxes that will pay their salary as they dismantle government. It's a sad day indeed. I haven't had time to really espouse on all the thoughts on my mind. Mr. Music Factory Man really nailed a bunch of it the other night. Keep on trucking, and I look forward to your shows. Dr. Sachs. He is a musician with the touring Count Basie Band. Thanks, Marshall. All right, we have... A couple of you at the last minute here tonight sent me something about this McDonald's in Canton, Ohio. Oh, my God. I mean, I don't know why anybody's surprised. This is what I'm going to share with you when you come back. Of course. Of course. We'll be right back. For the hour, one last comment here about all the news today. Reg writes, oh please, what terrorist, quote, quote, would send a supposedly dangerous package from Yemen to two synagogues in Chicago? It's like sending a bomb with a return address from KKK headquarters to the NAACP. It's so damn easy to manipulate the American public with the fear factor on the eve of the elections. Come on, Reg. BS. It was UAE Airlines, and they had two fighter planes escort them into JFK. Addressed to two synagogues. Ooh, who thought of that? What absolute wizard inside our intelligence apparatus that wanted to call attention to, oh, terrorists, Al-Qaeda, who came up with addressing packages to synagogues from, oh my God. There is a McDonald's restaurant, probably a bunch, but this one particular one in Canton, Ohio, is owned by a guy who obviously is not a liberal or a Democrat. He enclosed a handbill in his employees' paychecks the other day that threatened lower wages and benefits if Republicans don't win on Tuesday. That's right. The handbill said, as the election season is here, we wanted you to know which candidates will help our business grow in the future. As you know, the better our business does, it enables us to invest in our people and our restaurants. If the right people are elected, we will be able to continue with raises and benefits at or above our present levels. If others are elected, we will not. As always, who you vote for is completely your personal decision, and many factors go into your decision. The note ends, that's end quote, the note ends with a list of candidates that this particular McDonald's believes, quote, will help our business move forward, end quote. It names John Kasich for governor, Rob Portman for Senate, Jim Renacci for Congress. With the letter was a biography of Renacci. Attorney Alan Shulman of Kent Law Firm, so on and so on and so on, which received the documents from an employer who stepped forward, said, quote, the handbill endorses candidates who have, in essence, pledged to roll back the minimum wage and eviscerate the safety net that protects the most vulnerable members of our workforce. But it's more than that. When a corporation like McDonald's intimidates its employees into voting a specific way, it violates both state and federal election law. It's no surprise to anyone that Ohio is a battleground state in this election. And for a multinational corporation like McDonald's to threaten employees like this is morally and legally wrong. This despicable corporate conduct is the logical extension of the Citizens United decision, which has unleashed corporate arrogance and abuse, end quote. Attorney Shulman turned over the documents to local prosecutors, asking them to investigate, look for a criminal violation. Ohio election law specifically states that no corporation, quote, shall print or authorize to be print or post or exhibit in the establishment or anywhere in or about the establishment handbills containing any threat, notice or information that if any particular candidate is elected or defeated, work in the establishment will cease in whole or in part, or other threats expressed or implied intended to influence the political opinions of the votes or the votes of its employees, end quote. On Friday, the owner of the franchise, Paul Siegfried, apologized in a written statement saying the communication was, quote, an error of judgment on my part. Please know it was never my intention to offend anyone. For those that I have offended, I sincerely apologize. End quote. This is written, by the way, by Amanda Turkle at Huffington Post, and she writes in a statement to the Huffington Post, Shirley Rogers Reese, general manager of McDonald's Ohio region, said, quote, we wholeheartedly respect diverse views and opinions and our employees' right to vote. Our position is that every employee should make his or her own choice. McDonald's has no knowledge of this material being distributed. As independent business owners, our franchisees are responsible for matters regarding their own employees. The content of this material is not reflective of McDonald's position. We remain Yeah, well, that's true. McDonald's are franchises. I don't know what attorney Alan Shulman of the Canton Law Firm, Shulman Shiver and Biver, has in mind when he says when a corporation like McDonald's intimidates its employees It was the local franchisee, Mr. Schulman. You need to brush up a little bit on how McDonald's operates. I don't know if McDonald's has any company or corporate-owned stores left. They probably do, but this was not one of them. Renacci's opponent, the one who was recommended you go vote for, his opponent, Jim Baccieri, a Democrat, put out a statement about the incident, quote, "Sadly, these voter intimidation tactics by this McDonald's franchise owner," see, Jim got it right, "is another example of corporations exerting undue influence on our elections, something we've seen all too often lately, including earlier this year in the Citizens United decision, blah, 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 blah," end quote. Well, the problem here is the voters in this particular district in Ohio really won't give too much of a damn at all. They'll just continue to eat the filth that flows out of the McDonald's, and they'll continue to vote Republican. It is 7 past the hour. This is our Halloween or Samhain program, hence the creepy, weird music. And coming up after the break at the bottom of the hour, the famous or infamous reading that I do every year of Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart. Stick around for that. A perspective from Ohio, from Sue in Ohio, regarding the McDonald's story. Sue writes, "About that McDonald's in Canton, it's quite ironic how the neocon rhetoric has come full circle. The neo-pigs try to disguise their contempt for worker organization by saying the card check bill would take away a worker's right to a private ballot. And now the neo-pigs are trying to take away those same employers' rights to a private ballot by passing out veiled threats along with their paychecks. Go figure. Also, I live in the 16th district, which includes Canton, and have already voted early for Baccieri, of course. The neo-pigs don't want anyone calling Jim Renacci, the Republican, a tax cheat, so I'm curious as to how they would define him. Renacci and his wife claimed they had a negative $250 in earnings, but by the time an audit was complete, it was revealed that they had actually earned over $13.5 million for that year, a negative $250,000 in earnings. But when an audit was complete, it was revealed that they had actually earned $13.5 million for the year. They owed over $1 million in taxes, interest, and penalties by the time it was all done. Sadly, it looks as if Renacci will be our new 16th district rep, which is why our dinner menu Tuesday night coming will consist solely of Miller Lite and mudslides. Hugs and happy Halloween to you, Kathy and Molly. A tax cheat, a negative $250,000 in earnings, and turns out he had $13.5 million. And the people in the 16th district will vote him in. And why not? He's a lying son of a bitch Republican. Of course he's going to get elected. Of course he will. John Stewart's rally to restore sanity is Sunday. And as Robert Perry at consortiumnews.com points out, Stewart has found a comedic way to focus national attention on a serious issue. Will the United States begin acting like a responsible force in the world? Or will it continue to wander off into its own ghastly dreamscape? Millions of Americans have responded positively to Stewart's message, with thousands arriving from all over the country to take part in John Stewart's semi-serious rally at the National Mall on Saturday. Oh, it's Saturday? Okay. But other Americans are confused about why someone would call a march for sanity. And some who get the point are perturbed by its implicit criticism of their own craziness. Whether Stewart's rally will have any lasting effect is another question. Is it possible that many Americans don't want to be sane? Or put differently, are they addicted to the crazy? Is watching the madness of Glenn Beck simply too much fun? Are Rush Limbaugh's rants a way for listeners to feel better about their own personal grievances by blaming the hated liberals or the minorities or some other scapegoats? Especially on the right, crazy has become the bread and butter. For Muslim haters like Michael Savage and Stephen Emerson, not to mention the bigger names like Limbaugh and Beck, irrationality and fear-mongering are how they rile up their audiences and make their money. Crazy also is how you trump rationality. You can dismiss it as liberal elitism brought to you by those pointy-headed, we know better than you do, Al Gore types, folks who want us to listen to the scientists as they explain about the looming calamity of global warming and stuff like that. Isn't it more fun to simply call scientific judgments myths and feel superior to all those PhD guys? To the religious right, irrationality has another role, as a defense of biblical truth, so-called, in the face of reason. Anyone who operates under the principle of empiricism and objectivity is by definition a liberal for not accepting the Bible as the provider of all the answers. Many centrists are uncomfortable with John Stewart's rally for a different reason. They may find his jokes amusing, but they reject his more serious message that the U.S. political media process has gone quite literally mad. If you're a Washington Post or CNN-style journalist, you simply can't accept that the system you have helped sustain is insane. To do so, and to be honestly self-critical would require acknowledging that you sat on your hands in the face of George W. Bush's violent delusions of the past decade, because to do otherwise would have put your salary at risk. For these centrists to accept the need to restore sanity would require them to admit they tolerated madness. Still, the American right must be seen as the principal culprit in the decoupling of America from rationality. The latest manifestation of the right's wackiness can be found in the rise of the Tea Party, a movement of supposedly grassroots, mad as hell, regular Americans. However, even that image is an illusion. The reality is that the movement is heavily subsidized by wealthy corporate donors, such as the billionaire Koch brothers, who want to ensure deregulation of their industries. The reality that the Tea Party's phony grassroots obscures is that the hated federal government is the only force potentially powerful enough, if it were engaged on behalf of the people, to counter the overwhelming might of multinational corporations. By hobbling the government, the Tea Partiers are simply empowering the corporations to run everything. But the Tea Partiers have been persuaded that they are the new revolutionaries fighting for America against all those who would sap its strength, from the liberals and the illegals to the Muslims and the atheists, but most of all, from the federal government itself. Woo-hoo! But how did the United States of America get here? How could the most powerful nation on earth, with a sophisticated media, reach this place where a comedian is needed to point out how crazy the political system has become. In the 1980s, early in the Reagan administration, as an investigative reporter for the Associated Press, I was encountering so much deceptive propaganda regarding U.S. policies on Central America that I half jokingly asked an editor, what should an American news organization do if the U.S. government went from lying once in a while to lying all the time? The realistic answer at AP and other mainstream news organizations was to retreat and to avoid any head-on battles. The thinking was that the cheerful dishonesty of Ronald Reagan, a former actor and ad pitchman, would eventually fade away and rationality would return, that the pendulum would swing back on its own. But the imaginary pendulum never worked. Instead, through the 1980s, the right used its combined power of the executive branch and the emerging right-wing media to assert control over reality itself. A few politicians and journalists fought back, but most accommodated and waited. Meanwhile, Reagan won over large segments of the U.S. electorate with his something-for-nothing promises. Indeed, his greatest role as an actor may have been as the Pied Piper leading the American people off to their doom. More on this when we come back from the break. I'm Mike Malloy. After the break at the bottom of the hour, Telltale Heart. Back to what Robert Perry has put together. Reagan promised that tax cuts tilted to the rich would generate more revenue and eliminate the federal debt, that this money also could finance a massive military buildup which would frighten America's enemies and restore national prestige, that freeing corporations from government regulations and from powerful unions would herald a new day of prosperity brought about by the magic of free trade and free markets, that the country could turn its back on alternative energy and simply drill for more oil, that whites no longer had to feel guilty about the plight of blacks, that traditional values, i.e. rejection of the counterculture, would bring back the good old days when men were men and women were women. Despite the appeal of Reagan's message to many, it was essentially an invitation to reject reality. But tax policy wasn't Reagan's only ignore the future policy. Rejecting President Jimmy Carter's warnings about the need for renewable energy sources, Reagan removed Carter's solar panels from the White House roof and left the nation dependent on oil. Reagan also led campaigns to break unions and to free corporations from government regulations. In foreign policy, although the Soviet Union was in rapid decline, Reagan put ideological blinders on the CIA's analysts to make sure they exaggerated the Soviet menace and justified his military buildup. Reagan achieved this politicization of the CIA by placing in charge his campaign chief, William Casey, who in turn picked a young CIA careerist named Robert Gates to purge the analytical division of its long tradition of objectivity. Gates arranged the scariest intelligence estimates possible. Reagan also credentialed a group of young intellectuals who became known as the neoconservatives, the likes of Elliot Abrams, Richard Perle, and Robert Kagan, who emerged from an elitist tradition advocated by philosopher Leo Strauss that it was their proper role to manipulate the less educated masses and guide the people in a desired direction. The neocons worked with seasoned CIA propagandists like Walter Raymond Jr., who was moved over to the National Security Council to develop what was then called perception management for controlling how the American people would see and understand things. The neocons used fear, exaggeration, and lying to get the American people behind Reagan's support for brutal military regimes in El Salvador and Guatemala, as well as the Contra rebels seeking to overthrow Nicaragua's leftist Sandinista government. Perception management operatives targeted honest journalists, human rights activists, and congressional investigators who dug up unwanted facts that challenged Reagan's propaganda. To discredit truthful messages, the neocons controversialized the messengers. Meanwhile, the American right was building its own media infrastructure with wealthy foundations footing the bills for a host of political magazines. Far-right religious cult leader Sun Myung-moon poured billions of mysterious dollars into the Washington Times and other media operations. Meanwhile, by contrast, the American left, mostly underfunded or even defunded its scattered media outlets. Some, like Ramparts and Dispatch News, were shuttered, while others formerly left-of-center publications like the New Republic and the Atlantic changed hands to neocon and conservative owners. Despite the long-term costs, Reagan made many Americans feel good in the short run. Many bought into Reagan's notion that government is the problem. In 1984, Reagan's gauzy "Morning in America" vision won big over Walter Mondale's appeal for fiscal responsibility. On election night 1994, Democrats were stunned by how effective the tactic of using bogus and hyped anti-Clinton charges proved to be. Between the smearing of Bill and Hillary Clinton and the voters' desire to punish Democrats for raising taxes to close the Reagan-Bush era deficits, the Republicans swept to control of the House and the Senate. In the years that have followed, especially with the emergence of Fox News in the mid to late 90s, the dominance of right-wing propaganda over non-ideological reality moved to the center of the American political process. The rout of rationality was on. When we come back, the telltale heart. Stick around.
Sight, for my monster from a slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble abodes to get a jolt from my electrodes.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash. The zombies were having fun. The party had just begun.
True. Nervous. Very, very dreadfully nervous I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad?
The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object there was none. Passion there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold, and so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now this is the point. You fancy me mad. Madmen know nothing, but you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it also gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, closed, that no light shone out. And then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly. Very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ha! Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh so cautiously, cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight. But I found the eye always closed, and so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone and inquiring how he had passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man indeed to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked in upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moved more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could barely contain my feelings of triumph. To think that there I was, opening the door little by little, and he not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea. And perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly, as if startled. Now, you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch, with the thick darkness, for the shutters were close, fastened, through fear of robbers. And so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on steadily, steadily. I had my head in, and was about to open the lantern, when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quiet, and still, and said nothing. For a whole hour I did not move a muscle, and in the meantime I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed, listening, just as I have done night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief. Oh, no, it was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul. When overcharged with awe, I knew the sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it has welled up from my own bosom, deepening with its dreadful echo the terrors that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt. I pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise, when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor, or it is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with these suppositions, but he had found all in vain. All in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he never saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how stealthily, until at length a simple dim ray, like the thread of a spider, shot from out the crevice and fell full upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide open. And I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, all a dull blue with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray as if by instinct precisely upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the sense? Now, I say there came to my ears a dull, low, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier on to courage. But even yet I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could to maintain the ray upon the eye. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say, louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous, so I am. And now, at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet for some minutes longer I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst, and now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once only. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no longer. If still you think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the boards so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no stain of any kind, no blood spot whatever. I had been too wary for that. A tub had caught all when I had made an end of these labors. It was 4:00, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I now to fear? There entered three men who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled, for what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search. Search well. I led them at length to his chamber. I showed him his treasure, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But ere long I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied ringing in my ears, but still they sat and still chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definiteness until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. No doubt I now grew very pale, But I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice, yet the sound increased. And what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much like a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key and with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards. But the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, 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 and still the men chanted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God, no! No, they heard! They suspected! They knew! They were making a mockery of my horror. This, I thought, and this, I think. But anything else, anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. And now, again, hark, louder, 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 louder. Villains, I shrieked, dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here, here, it is the beating of his hideous heart.
Of America is in these small towns that we get to visit and in these wonderful little pockets of what I call real America, very patriotic, very pro-America areas of this great nation.
It's about 9 before the hour. Email from Bill, Emory University in Atlanta, who writes, well, here we are on the cusp of a Republican stampede. Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin are the new national opinion makers, and stomping on the heads of liberals is the new fashion, both literally and figuratively. I find myself agreeing with Bill Maher when he rails about the hillbilly electorate that has zero ability to understand issues. It is pretty remarkable and disheartening that the people at the bottom of the food chain are jumping on the Tea Party bandwagon as if lower taxes on corporations and billionaires, a Somalia-like reduction in government services, and a theocracy are magically going to improve our economic prospects. On the other hand, I'm totally frustrated with the Democrats, who by and large are just as corrupt as the Republicans. You can't get reelected without spending massive amounts on media, and that, of course, means taking corporate money. We clearly need a constitutional amendment that overturns the Supreme Court's decision validating unlimited corporate support. Good luck with that ever happening. The real problem here is the obvious fact that 60 years of television and 30 years of talk radio have utterly cretinized the voting public. These media wink and seduce and bombard you with their lies and distortions, and most people are caught in the trance. It's Skinnerian conditioning by trope, and it's remarkably effective. Combine this conditioning with an economic disaster, and you have a perfect storm for a Republican landslide in the midterms and the next presidential election. George Bush's cowboy capitalism got us into this mess, and it could get catastrophically worse if these brain-dead teabaggers in league with the corporate interests get their way. Canada is beginning to look really good. Nova Scotia and Vancouver are on my radar. Okay, so how do we get Obama reelected? I've certainly been disappointed with his with his governing from the middle strategy. And the fact the banking maggots who caused this mess aren't in jail and their companies broken apart. Where's Teddy Roosevelt when we need him? As everyone knows, Obama's great weakness is that he can't communicate with stupid people. And that's a fatal flaw in any politician. His obvious intelligence worked for him when he needed to prove he wasn't just another dumb minority politician. But now it's a liability. Voters ultimately want someone as dumb as they are. Which brings me to Sarah Palin's candidacy. I propose that Democrats everywhere register as Republicans and vote for the Mama Grizzly as the Republican presidential nominee. I think that is Obama's only chance. The only other option would be for Democrats to sponsor a third-party candidate that would split the moron vote. Of course, Palin or a third-party candidate could win. So this is a calculated risk. But we really have no other choice. Virtually any other Republican nominee will beat Obama, in my view. What did H.L. Mencken say? Someday the American people will elect a perfect idiot? I thought that was W. But Sarah Palin makes George Bush look downright thoughtful. How low can we sink? Perhaps Glenn Beck will run. I think he would actually get elected. The new Reagan, a third-rate comedian, isn't much different from a second-rate actor. They both know how to play to the crowd. There's a stunningly prescient film that predicts the state of our political discourse, Facing the Crowd by Elia Kazan. It's about a hobo singer who gets on the radio and becomes a national hero. The film was made in 1957, but is more relevant now than ever. Life is imitating art, and it isn't a pretty picture. Bill, who is at involved in film studies, Emory University, Atlanta. I think he stole my idea. Don't you think? If that idea is followed through on, see, here in Georgia, it's very easy to, first of all, we have open primaries. Anybody can vote any way they want to. There's one catch. If you vote in a Republican primary, then you have to vote the Republican ticket in the general. But it gives a lot of leeway to political tricksters who want to make sure that the worst candidate for the other party will get nominated. Now, the other party here in Georgia is always the Democrats. Well, I shouldn't say always. It has been for the past 15, 20 years. And that's because the Republicans have so dominated Georgia politics, which doesn't really surprise anybody who lives here because this state is pretty much still struggling to get out of the 1970s in a lot of ways, and in other ways, the 1870s. So it's been very interesting to watch how all this works. You know what I'm saying? We have a break coming here. When we come back, we're probably going to take some phone calls. This is the top of the hour break. That's right. Okay. When we come back, after this break, we'll take some phone calls. And we have podcast trivia coming at the bottom of the hour. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Samhain program, or for those of you who don't use the Irish pronunciation, it is Halloween, our Halloween show. Back to your, or let's go to your phone calls. You want to do that? Let's do it. Arnold is in Durham, North Carolina. Hello, Arnold.
Hey, Mike.
Hey.
How you doing, brother?
I'm all right.
Good. Listen, I was listening to you as you talk about, you know, in preparation of what's going to happen on Tuesday, you talk about going to, what did you say, Nova Scotia or somebody from Canada?
Not me. That was somebody that wrote in.
Oh, I agree. Say, man, I know you used to live in Toledo, where you had, your body was used to that kind of temperature.
That's
and
right.
And now you're living in Georgia. And I know your body nowhere near that temperature. And neither have I live in the South, too. And I'm going to have to probably get on your cruise and just maybe ban and ship one of them places down there where they stop at, you know.
There you go. Because, yeah, that cruise is going to a lot of places.
Yeah, maybe me and my wife, we can just pack ourselves up and bail up when you get to one of those nice places.
Let's do it.
Probably just stay in it.
Bring your passport.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely got to do that now. Oh man, I'm telling you, this is something else, man. I listen to these people here talk, and it's crazy over here. And you know me, with me being in the trucking world, I listen to these crazies on the CB, man. I mean, they are so pumped up, man, about being. And I say to myself, you know, in this country, black people, they're disparageable race. I mean, like they always get the most cancer, the most this. The worst is this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The disparaging rate.
Right.
But one thing they beat white people in and beat them in very good is their ability to not vote against their own best interests, you know?
Yeah, that's
sick. These guys
that's
the will
truth.
Vote against
let me ask you something.
Man, every time.
Arnold,
right now, I'm stopped at a restaurant in West Virginia. And I'm listening to these commercials that comes on every 15 seconds. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Then listen to these people, you know? You played it one night. You played the tapes of some guy made doing the tea bag thing with
right.
Beck and everything.
Right, right.
And that guy interviewed some people. I was just in a shock.
Well, Arnold, hey, yo, Arnold, when you listen to this chatter, when you listen to people in the CB talking about, you know, they just can't wait until the Republicans take over. What do they think is going to happen?
They don't know. They have no clue, man.
Well,
they no clue.
Then why do you suppose they're so damn happy?
I don't know. I mean, you know, they're being led to the fiery pit, and I guess they're getting ready to jump over in it because it's going to be hell for them.
Yeah, this is a part I can't understand. You know, I hear the same thing here in Georgia. You know, people, it's like the anticipation right before a massive rat killing or something. I mean, these fools are crazy. And they're talking about how good it's going to be to elect Republicans so they can go after Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama, and so they can overturn what they call Obamacare. And I'm thinking to myself, what is it that has made this country insane? I mean, insane. What is it?
It's the corporate. I think it's just the corporate powers taking over, and they. It's just like going back to the what do you call it? The age back there when they had full power.
The Gilded Age. Why did the corporations want people in power who are complete dumbasses? Why did the corporations want the vast middle class in this country to be gutted? I mean, who's going to buy the junk that these corporations turn out? Well, I'm just talking, Arnold. I don't have a clue, and I know you don't. And I don't, and I don't think most people have a clue as to why this continues, where people, mm-hmm. these Republicans, continue to just drag that knife back and forth across their own damn throats. Just slice,
exactly.
slice.
Exactly.
And you want to say, look, you're bleeding to death. No, I'm not. Yeah, you are. That's your blood down there on the floor. I don't care. Slice. What in the hell is wrong with these people?
Michael, as long as I've been listening to you, the years I've listened to you, you've always said one thing. What's it going to take, America? What's it going to take to get your ass built into the streets? And we're just going to, that question is going to befuddle us for the rest of our lives in this country until something changes. You know? But we're headed to Garkey Land. We're headed to that Banana Republic so fast, you know.
I hear him.
So I don't know.
All right, keep on trucking. that's a joke, Arnold. Be careful. All right.
All right, buddy. We'll see you.
All right. Take care. Take care. I'll tell you what. There certainly have been times in my political awareness. I'm just talking me right now. Where, you know, I've looked at the crazy way things are going, like Arnold said. You know, I look at it and I think, okay, folks are going to pull back from this madness. It's just temporary insanity. I remember that was the case when George Wallace ran for the presidency. When was that? 68? Was it way back in 68? Or was it 72? It doesn't matter. I guess it was 72. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, really. But how crazy certain white folks in the South got about George Wallace. Now, he had a weird background. At one time, he was a white Southerner who was not anti-civil rights. He was not any more anti-black than the average white male Southerner. Now, that sounds like, what are you talking about? But George Wallace, I'm trying to say, was not a racist when he started out, but he got defeated in a couple elections, and he said nobody would ever out N-word him again. And that's when he went crazy. That was back in the 50s. And that's when he went crazy. Well, when he made his famous stand in the schoolhouse door at the University of Alabama and yada, 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 and the federal troops had to come in, you know, all posturing, all nonsense. Well, he got elected. He got elected again. Then he couldn't get elected. And then his wife, Lurleen, got elected, and he ran the governorship. And of course, she died of cancer. And then old George just got he got shot when he ran for president. What was that guy's name? Bremer, Arthur Bremer, took a shot at him, paralyzed him. And George Wallace's last probably 15, 18 years, 20 years of life was in absolute physical pain. And towards the end, you know, he was apologizing to anybody and everybody as long as they had dark skin. He would just invite just all kinds of people in, black folk, and said, tell about how sorry he was. And, oh, Lord, how's that? And, of course, black folk here in the South, it's been my observation. I'm not talking like I know anything. I'm just saying it's my observation. Are more than willing to forgive crazy white people. Unless the crazy white people done things like lynching or, you know, something like that. That they're not going to forgive, right? But black folk in the South, I have noticed, have a tendency to forgive crazy white people. Even somebody as crazy as, what's his name? Kathy Pickrick restaurant here. Well, he was governor. Who was that fool? I got his picture up on the wall, a picture of him and Jack. Lester Maddox, right. Even somebody as crazy and weird as Lester Maddox used to chase black folk away from his chicken restaurant with an axe handle. I mean, even as crazy as he was, Atlanta black folk, I'm just saying what I saw. I don't know anything. But black folks seemed to forgive him, the old bastard, when he was dying of prostate cancer and his wife died of cancer. All these white people get cancer. And then they bring in as many black people as they can and say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean, because they know that they're about, in their minds anyway, they're about to go meet God. And the thing that they're afraid of is they're going to get up there and God is going to be this black woman who's going to look at him and say, why are you here? And you know, Lester Max, George Wallace, whoever, going to go, oh my God. And she'll say, that's right. Now answer my question. Why are you standing in front of me like that? A werewolf drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's. His hair was perfect.
Hey, neocons, don't be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Marty is calling from Kansas City, listening on XM. Hello, Marty.
Greetings, Kansas City, Kent, or as I like to put it.
Can you, Marty? Can you talk up a little bit? Talk right into your phone or whatever you have there, Marty.
There, I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, a little bit better. Yeah, go ahead.
How much better does it have to be? A state-of-the-art phone.
I'm sorry?
It's a state-of-the-art phone. I've done this before, Mike.
Your voice is totally distorting out. I'll put you on hold for a minute. Maybe you need to get to a better cell, but we can barely make out what you're saying. Sanchez is in East L.A. Hello, Sanchez.
A very good evening to you, Senor Malloy.
How are you?
I'm okay. Because of your Halloween program here, I'm wearing my Ronald Reagan rubber mask. And I'm here to say, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help.
Yeah, okay. All right.
A couple of different things here, because you've been bouncing back and forth between truth from the government and the teabaggers, and a couple of different random thoughts. But first of all, I wanted to say the name of the person that, on air, the name of the person that was telling the stories about Martha Mitchell that I relayed a few weeks ago, that was Dick Gregory. And it was in a speech that was a videotape, but it was not a television program. I'm sorry. I think the chemtrails are making my memory go fuzzy here, so I couldn't remember that. I couldn't believe that.
Right.
Yeah. Right. You know, as far as truth coming out of the government, I would not count on that. As much as we, as the truth seekers, as the progressives, as those that are in the truth squads or in We Are Change or any number of other local activist groups are demanding it, I honestly, I am an optimist, but I'm also a realist, but I honestly don't see anything forthcoming unless there's just some major, major cataclysm because of the fact that any revelation about truth, for example, I mean, any significant thing about the JFK assassination or the real reason behind Vietnam or for example, that 9/11 was an inside job. If any of these things were to be revealed to the average American person, not only would there be a backlash against the government, but there would be also a backlash against the media for helping to be, to help cover up and not to do their job as the fourth estate. So as much as we know about the truth, as much as we can see and hear and understand what the world is about, I'm afraid that the powers that be have too tight a grip at this point on the sheeple to be able to allow anything like that to happen. I mean, you know, there are other things that we could talk about here, but with a group like the teabaggers now being propped up as the norm for American behavior here, the teabaggers, a collective group of what, 75 IQ points is their average score, with no more than just a few quotes from Glenn Beck in their pockets to lean back on. I can see this country in about 100 years, Mike. Have you ever seen a film by chance by a guy named Mike Judge? He's the same guy that does Beavis and Butthead cartoons and the family. He did a movie about 4 years ago.
No, I don't.
Go ahead.
No, the title of the movie is what?
Idiocracy.
No, I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it, no.
You probably would get by with watching the first 20 minutes of it, because the premise is excellent. Watching the first 10 minutes will tell you everything about how he sees the world in about 100 years from now. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's showing basically a bunch of, like, trailer park people versus, like, the more educated and the more evolved, like, say, us progressives. Us progressives realistically see that there's a problem with population here on the earth. So we choose not to populate with too many children. But your average teabagger, your trailer parkers, or the people that are that collectively are breeding on the planet, well, you know, they're allowed to breed like cockroaches. And in about 100 years from now, the collective mindset of this country goes down to about, again, 75 IQ points.
Sanchez, first of all, I'm sure you're not saying that everybody lives in a...
Well,
In a trailer park or a mobile home, there's something wrong with them. Secondly, this 100 years, what are you talking 100 years? We're already there. I mean, it's now. It's not 100 years, pal. It's right here, right now. We have people who are going to go vote on Tuesday who couldn't, I mean, they couldn't define the first term that would come out of a lecture on civic responsibility or on political history of this country. It's just not going to happen. We have, idiocracy, a stupidocracy, bohunks, morons, idiots. But I'll tell you what, they don't live, the ones I know don't live in trailer parks. They live in, $300,000, $400,000 houses. They're retired. They're living on the dole. They're living on all sorts of this investment or that investment or this government program or that government program. And you're not going to convince them anything is wrong. They just want more. They want it all. Sanchez, they got to live it there. Leave it there. When we come back, podcast trivia. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
Cowboy, change your ways. They are with us. You will ride. Trying to catch the devil's herd across these endless skies. Yippee-yi-yo.
You are now entering a flying monkey free zone. It's Mike Malloy.
It's something weird, and it don't look good. Who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters! I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
25 before the hour. On the Malloy Samhain or Halloween program, Fright Night. All right, I think it is. Yes, it is! It is time once again, ladies and gentlemen, for podcast trivia. Very simple, you get the right answer, we will give you a 1-year subscription to Malloy program podcast downloads, commercial free. Retail value of $59.60 because it goes on for a year. That means each one is worth 25 cents. A 2-bit radio program indeed. Let's see who we have here who wants to take a shot at this. Mike is in Burlington, Iowa. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Fair to partly cloudy. Are you ready to play this?
I guess.
All right.
Can I steal answers from my cat?
Sure. All right, Maestro, play the music, please. Here we go. Oh, turn it down a little bit. That would help. All right, Mike, here's your question. Another potential election season terrorist attack today against the United States. And as usual, it comes just days before the voters go to the polls. According to corporate news reports, did the threat come from A, Pakistan, B, Ethiopia, C, Yemen, or D, Dick Cheney's bedroom?
I may actually have to go with the old college answer of guess C when you're not sure and guess B. Although D would be better.
So all right.
I'll take C, and, D might actually turn out to be the real one.
All right, you're going to go with C. That's it!
Had to be Yemen, because isn't that where Al-Awlaki is?
I think so. And again, the question contains the qualifier, according to corporate news reports. Did the threat come from A, B, C, or Dick Cheney's bedroom? I frankly have a suspicion it might have come from someplace else. Among the list of possible jumping off points for this these aircraft today, and their packages anyway, not the aircraft, but their packages. It could have been Langley, Virginia, which is CIA headquarters. It could be from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It could be from Karl Rove. It could be from CIA. Any number of people who are desperately trying to close the chapter on American representative government. It's almost closed anyway with these phony voting machines. But So corporate news said it was probably from Yemen.
Did they raise the alert level to mauve by chance?
No. The alert level thing, the candy-colored tangerine flake baby thing that they used during the Bush-Cheney reign of terror, and John Ashcroft and the rest of these monsters used, that was Bush stuff. That was Cheney stuff. That was John Ashcroft stuff. We don't do that anymore. You would think after this event today, let's pretend it's all real. After this event today, they would raise it to red, but nobody even talks about that anymore. Remember all that? Today is a code yellow, code orange, code blue, green, red, purple, pink. Nobody does it anymore, and you got to wonder, well, why? Is the terror issue been solved?
Didn't Tom Ridge say that they made him up as they went along
of course,
with politics?
Of course. Any time. And that's the reason I have a very hard time with the reports today. In his book, Tom Ridge made it very clear that the color-coded terror alerts would rise and fall depending on specifically whether or not elections were going to happen, or if a piece of legislation was trying to work its way, Bush legislation trying to make its way through the Congress, and they needed that little extra oomph that you need when you are lying and committing fraud on the American people. So, yeah, the color-coded terror alert would rise one color at least, and that usually prompted people to get things done, right?
Yep.
We live in a house of mirrors. Mike, can you hold on?
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, could I make one comment since it's Halloween?
Sure. Go ahead.
I thought that they needed to have a Halloween costume contest of who, what, and where, who to dress up, what to dress them up at, where to have them trick or treat. And I thought you could start with Sarah Palin as the Grim Reaper, send her to Dick Cheney's house.
He'd have a heart. Well, wait a minute. He couldn't have a heart attack. He doesn't really have a heart anymore. That's a good idea. I think.
You could take Michelle Bachmann as the Wicked Witch.
Ah! What a piece
of. And send her out to trick or treat in a heavy rainstorm.
I'm melting. All right, Mike. Thanks. Hold on a second. Kathy will get the information. Isn't it kind of strange? The Nation had an article about this. I think the issue before this one. All these weird, screwball-y, right-wing women who are running from public office. Everybody from Meg Whitman, who feels she can spend $150 million to lose an election, all the way to Sharon Angel, who is so out in the ether. It's a wonder she doesn't walk around with a nosebleed all the time. To Christine O'Donnell, to Carly Fiorina, to Michelle Bachmann, to, you know, the doyen, the chief nut crazy person of them all, Sarah Palin. All of these right-wing women, there's not an ounce of sanity among the whole group. But isn't it unusual? Or maybe not. Maybe not. I don't know. It's hard to figure. Every single teabag or right-wing woman who is, running for office, I hate to dignify what they're doing by calling it running for office, but every one of them is out of her goddamn mind, just completely insane, no grasp of anything that makes any sense where concerns politics or leadership or governance. You know, they talk about Meg Whitman. Meg Whitman is out there trying to tell people that since she had experience in a corporate world, she'll be good at at running the state of California or whatever the hell it is she's trying to do. Is she? Yeah, she's the one running for governor. Well, Jesus H. God, what did Meg Whitman do? I mean, what did Meg Whitman do? She made so much money she can throw $140 million down the crapper while she forced out of work thousands of people. That's a qualification to be a leader, to be a governor? Oh, my God. And what did Carly Fiorina do? Almost bankrupt Hewlett-Packard? I don't get this. Sarah Palin is a quitter, walks away from a job that she took an oath to and the voter. And Sharon Angle, where did this little monster twisted? I mean, look in Sharon Angle's face once. And be careful, because if you have the wrong attitude, you'll turn to stone. And Bachman, who rails against the federal government, and her husband has just been sucking money out of Medicaid and Medicare with this phony-ass rest home or whatever they have somewhere tucked back in the piney woods of Minnesota. What is with these people? But hey, come Tuesday, they're going to be running the country. Yes, by God, governorships, senatorial positions, representatives, they're gonna fix that Barack Obama. They're gonna stop Nancy Pelosi. What a herd of half-witted jackasses. Where did these people come from? But the women, the women of the flying monkey right are insane. They're crazy. Every single one of them is out there touting a kind of governance that will destroy everything women have gained in the past 90 years. Utterly and absolutely trash it. This country is in the middle of an absolute nervous breakdown. It is going insane.
And she's playing with my mind. And I don't mind, I don't mind. No, I don't mind, I don't mind. No, I don't mind, I don't
before the hour, I haven't mentioned it lately, but a big thanks to our correspondents, Sharon Gordy, Military Affairs, Bruce Enberg, Economics, Kay Petrini, Education, Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf, program's ethics advisors, and of course our producer and engineer, Kathy Bay. Ba-da. Mark is in San Francisco. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. I think we can call them now the Republican Nazi Party.
I don't think there's any doubt.
There is no doubt. You got brown shirts. You got war crimes. You've got torture. You've got hate speech. It's right out of the Nazi playbook. The only thing we don't have are ovens that they could put us in, but they're probably financially going to do that to us, or try to anyway.
Yeah.
My question to you, Mike, is how long do you think it's going to be when they put down their agenda before we get some resistance?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I'm hoping it'll be fairly quick in terms of how revolutions normally explode. The disparity between in income in this country now is reaching the point that alone has the ability to inspire people to revolt, to say, no, I've had enough of this. The fact that so many of us are unemployed, so many of us are losing the basic element of living in this country, and that is a place to live. I mean, Jesus God, it is madness out here, just absolute madness. Now, the teabaggers who have no agenda whatsoever except removing Obama from office. I mean, that's it. These are people who are literally insane. So
they are insane. And yeah, like the Republican Party just wants to take away more programs that people need. Since they put them out of work, they need them more than ever. And these fascist Nazis are going to just make it worse for everybody in this country. They don't care.
The ultimate goal is to go back to the kind of labor force and ruling class that existed in this country up until the Civil War, and that is a slave society where labor is free. As we talked about in this program so many times, one of the biggest costs that the capitalists just hate with a passion because they can't control it is labor cost.
Well, you know, Mike, not everybody in this country is stupid, and not everybody's going to take this Republican bullshit too much longer. So they can go ahead with their agenda, but...
That's true, but Mark, you're not supposed to say... Why can't he say that? Why can't he say that word? Mark, I know... we get loosey-goosey on this program, but there's a couple of words we're not supposed to say, and the BS word is one of them. But anyway, thanks for checking in. I know what you're saying, and I completely, thoroughly, absolutely, with no doubt whatsoever, agree that we are in it up to our eyeballs. And how long, I think your question was how long it's going to take before the American public, the sane people, react to the kind of legislative programs these pigs are going to initiate. I don't know. You've heard everybody from Mike Pence, who is a real psychopath. Well, all just write down the list of these people. That one of the first goals is to overturn the Health Care Reform Act. Which I certainly did not support when it was being written, but I'll tell you what, there are some aspects of that, like guaranteeing that children have health insurance or can stay on their parents' policies till they're 26. They can't be denied health coverage because they have pre-existing conditions. Now, I know a lot of companies have responded to that by saying, well, we're not going to write policies for kids anymore. At some point, people in this country are going to realize that there is not going to be a let up from this brutality as long as the right wing is in control of the money flow in this country, in other words, the banking system, in control of transportation, in control of energy, in control of the political system, in control of the religious insanity. When people finally come to their senses and realize that the right wing in this country, the right wing in Germany, the right wing in Russia or the old Soviet Union, the right wing in Chile, the right wing in all these countries that have had their experience with fascism, and then somehow, if they survived, managed to survive and get over it. We haven't gone through that yet. We haven't gone through the reality of having a fascist government. I know a lot of lefties will disagree with me on that, but I mean fascist in a clear definitive sense so that people understand they're being ruled by fascism. Now, what will happen in this country when people finally realize what the teabaggers are, what this piece of vomit Glenn Beck is, and the rest of these right-wingers, and what they have done in convincing a sizable chunk of the American public to vote against themselves, to destroy their system of government. When that realization dawns, that, I think, will be the time when the American public will say, okay, it's time to go to the streets. And I don't mean to carry placards. So we'll see. I could be completely wrong. I'll see you Monday. Have a good weekend. Take care. Keep it lit.
This is the end. Beautiful.
Have a great weekend, Kevin Kinney, wherever you are.
This is the end. My only friend. Of our elaborate plans, the end of